Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live today from beautiful Urbana, Campbell Hall, the home of WILL, AM and FM, and television for that matter. And today we have a show that we've been planning for a long time to be a candidate debate for the three candidates for the 15th Congressional District seat in the United States House of Representatives. And we've had sort of a minor change in plans. We're having we'll have some semblance of that show, but not exactly what we planned. But before we get on to that and discuss that, a couple of announcements, if I could. First of all, I want to thank all of you listening. Last week was the pledge drive for WILL, and this program in particular was involved in that. And we had a terrific week, and I want to just thank all the listeners who contributed. It's greatly appreciated. You know, what we try to do here on Media Matters is bring perspectives before listeners in East Central Illinois. They would not have a chance to hear that frequently otherwise, discussing Media Matters, and also to take up topics that are not necessarily covered that widely or discussed that widely in the media, both public or commercial. And so, you know, that type of programming, this type of program is appreciated. It means a great deal to me, to the producers, Ben Scott and Ben Byrne, and to everyone at WILL. So thank you all very much. And while I'm at it, I should point out that next week's show, we're going to have a show on University of Illinois Press and University Publishing, discussion of where University Publishing fits into the big picture and what the big picture is in book publishing today. And if you aren't aware of this, be prepared for a fairly distressing program about the state of book publishing in the United States today. We're going to have the two heads of the University of Illinois Press as our guests 1 week from today, so mark that down in your calendar. This is a particularly sad moment for the Media Matters show and for many of us. Our flag is at half-staff here. On Friday, a friend of ours and a truly great American, Paul Wellstone, died a tragic death in an airplane accident with his wife, Sheila, his daughter, and five other people. Paul was not only a friend of mine, he's a friend of many people, but he had a tremendous interest in media issues and media politics. He wrote the introduction to one of my books, in fact, that came out 2 years ago. And we have posted Paul Wellstone's introduction on my website, which is simply robertmcchesney.com. I had the privilege to get to know him quite a bit in the past 5 or 6 years and deal with him. He came to my house in Madison once when I lived there. We met several times in Washington and in Madison and talked on the phone. And he was an extraordinary person, very rare for politics or for a politician, very rare for anything for that matter. And it's an enormous loss, this tragic death that took place. I think that for the sake of this program, what should be mentioned about Paul is that he was really quite concerned with what was happening with media in the United States, and not simply in the exact direction that media was going. Commercialism bothered him a great deal, concentration of ownership. But in particular, he was concerned about the lack of debate over media policy and media structure. It was some of the issues he really had told me he planned to pursue, in fact, in his third term, were he to win election this November, win re-election for a third term. And, you know, a lot of the inspiration for the work of this program has been sort of conversations with Paul Wellstone about how important it is to have public participation and forum debate over the policies that set up our media system, because he saw them going on in Washington basically behind closed doors. And he was really revolted by that, and it offended his democratic sensibility. So that's sort of the concept that was behind the plan for the show we're going to do today on Media Matters, was to really have a debate over media policies that Congress would consider. So we'd have the candidates come in and discuss the sort of issues they would be voting on in the next term or considering at the committee level, if not going to a formal vote, as members of Congress concerning media. And I think something that's often not significantly or suitably appreciated is that our media system didn't sort of fall out of the sky a couple thousand years ago and land on this continent, but instead is the result of policies that are made by the government in our names, but oftentimes without our informed consent or participation. And this is not a new thing. The founding fathers themselves, if you read the origins of the Republic and the history of it, particularly the debates surrounding the U.S. Constitution, media policy was actually a large part of their thinking. And in fact, some of the most impressive and thoughtful writings of Madison and Jefferson, our two most prominent constitutional thinkers, deal with how do you promote a free press? How do you promote a dialogue in society to have a free society? And we had a number of crucial, seminal media policies put in place, including the First Amendment, including copyright, both right in the Constitution, including second-class mailing subsidies to make it inexpensive and below cost for publications to be distributed nationwide. Absolutely essential policy for a free society. These were built right into the Republic's early history. Today, it's certainly no less the case. Those companies that have the privilege of broadcasting and radio and television get monopoly-enforced, government-enforced monopolies to scarce frequencies, to channels that they get for no charge whatsoever from the government. These are policies. There's nothing natural about that. We could go on and on. In short, the government plays an enormous role in setting up the type of media system that we have today and the way it operates. And some of the issues that we hope to talk about and some of the issues that members of Congress will be considering in the next session are issues like what are we to do with public broadcasting? How high should the subsidy go? How should it be managed? What about media ownership? Currently, the Federal Communications Commission is considering eliminating the handful of remaining regulations prohibiting media firms from getting bigger and bigger and buying up everything in sight. Should the Congress intervene to stop that, as many members of Congress are arguing, or should they just look the other way and let the FCC continue as it currently plans? Specifically, radio station ownership. In 1996, Congress greatly relaxed the ownership requirements in radio. It's become quite controversial, and several members of Congress, including Senator Russell Feingold from Wisconsin, have proposed legislation to try to change the nature of radio station ownership in the United States. Advertising to children, according to most pediatricians, has become almost a crisis situation for mental health for our children in this country. What should Congress do about that? And then two other issues that are front and center in political debate that go directly to media. One is copyright or intellectual property. What should be the proper role of copyright and how does the public get protected in the equation vis-a-vis the copyright holders? And secondly, political advertising. Political advertising has become the lingua franca of our political culture and goes directly to the relationship of our commercial media system, which benefits by political advertising. These are the sorts of issues members of Congress are going to be wrestling with the next term, and I'd hoped today to wrestle with them with the three candidates on the ballot for the 15th district here in Illinois. Now, I must say, unfortunately, we're not going to have all three of the candidates here. We knew going in when we started this idea for doing this debate to sort of launch this sort of discussion that the idea was to be rough at first. I mean, our goal down the road is that all candidates for federal office would have media policies, much like they have environmental policies, that they would debate these issues, that these are central issues that they couldn't avoid. So the public could participate as citizens and not just simply play no role whatsoever in these important government policies. We knew going in, however, that as in all races, if you have an incumbent who is heavily favored to win, it's extraordinarily difficult to get them to commit to a debate. And that's true whatever their party. Out in California, the governor, Gray Davis, will not go anywhere near debate if he can avoid it. And he certainly won't go near a debate if the third party candidate happens to be nearby. And unfortunately, in our district, we have an incumbent who's a heavy favorite, Mr. Johnson, Tim Johnson, and he has his staff. We've worked with very closely to try to encourage him to be on the show, but they have been quite honest to their credit that this was not something they were looking forward to enthusiastically. We've worked with them to try to send them the questions ahead of time, to let them pick the date for the other candidates to come, but Mr. Johnson's staff has finally elected that this is not something they wanted to participate in. Mr. Johnson's not here today, long and short of it, much to my regret. And I hope if he is reelected and we do this 2 years from now, he will elect to join us because it would be a much better program with his participation. That's not the half of it, unfortunately. Also missing is the Democratic candidate, Mr. Joshua Harkey, who was enthusiastically going to participate until this morning when we learned that he is going to be attending a memorial service for Paul Wellstone taking place this afternoon, and he sends his regrets, and we certainly understand his sentiments about Mr. Wellstone, and we wish he were here, but since he's not, we proceed on. So that means joining us today here in the studio after this long-winded 9-minute introduction is the Green Party candidate for the 15th District, United States House of Representatives seat from Illinois, Carl Estabrook. Carl, welcome to the show.
Bob, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. I've been a fan of your show and of your work for a long time, and I'm very happy to take the chairs that my opponents seem not to want to occupy. I'll do their parts if you want me to. I do it in different voices.
No, I don't think we're going to go that route.
Okay.
I somehow got a feeling that one wouldn't cut the mustard. I think instead what we're going to do is sort of change the format. I think a debate format clearly is inappropriate when you're one out of three candidates. This isn't Bulgaria.
Work on the contradictions in our campaign, maybe.
Yeah, I think instead what we'll do is, what I'd like to do in today's show is basically discuss media issues with you, your policies on them, your thoughts on them, and then open up the phone lines, and we'll open them up immediately. And callers can ask about media questions, or callers can take this opportunity to ask Carl Estabrook about any question they want concerning the campaign. This is an opportunity to speak directly to him. The number here at WILL is 333-9455. The lines are open. Our toll-free number, for those of you who are outside the immediate area, 800-222-9455. Our guest today, then, is Carl Estabrook, the Green Party candidate for the 15th congressional seat here in the state of Illinois. Carl, for people who are not familiar with you, what's your background?
I'm an academic, is the long and short of it, I think. I've never really wanted to do anything except teach in colleges, read and write, occasionally do a few things associated with that. I write newspaper columns, and I'm happy to say that I do a radio show and have for a long time on the sibling station, WEFT. My colleague Paul Muth and I have occupied the hour from 10 to 11 a.m. for a dozen years here in Champaign on WEFT, talking about politics each week.
Mm-hmm. And then what leads you to run for office now, then, if you had such a happy life as an academic?
Well, it's true. The Green Party asked me. The Green Party, and the Green Party, remember, takes seriously its principle of grassroots democracy. It's quite a decentralized organization. So we have here in Champaign-Urbana the group that call themselves the Prairie Greens, but there's also a separate Green Party organization, McLean County and in Coles County. There's a state organization that brings these together, but that's also, you know, wonderfully contentious and decentralized. The Prairie Greens came to me beginning of the year and pointed out that the Democratic Party wasn't going to run anyone against Timothy Johnson as a Republican, as the Republican incumbent in this 15th district. The district was being redrawn. It was geographically much larger than the one that Johnson had lived in or had won in last time. And Johnson was, in fact, a first-term incumbent. You talk about this being, in some sense, a safe Republican seat, and it is, but not because Johnson has held it for so long. I mean, he moved into the seat after having been an apparatchik for the Republican establishment here in the state since he first ran for the city council in his mid-20s. But what happened was that the Democrats decided, look, the man's unbeatable. We can spend our money and time more worthwhile in a more worthwhile fashion elsewhere, so let's give him a free ride back to Washington. Green Party came to me and said, does this seem right to you? And I said, no, it didn't. It would be worthwhile indeed to try to point out the ways in which the Green Party differed with both the Republicans and the Democrats by, in this case, running a candidate against Tim Johnson. They asked me if I'd be interested, and I said I would indeed. And so for the last 6 months, that's what I've been doing. One thing they didn't tell me was how much fun it was going to be, by the way. It's been a ball.
Now, you had to get on the ballot, as I understand. I mean, you had to get enough signatures to get on the ballot, which other candidates, a Democrat or Republican, their parties are already going to be on the ballot due to success in previous elections.
Yeah.
And if you do well in this election, will the Greens automatically be on the ballot? What will it take for the next Green candidate in 2 years running for this position to go automatically on the ballot?
The Greens will automatically be on the ballot for this office, that is, for a seat in the House of Representatives from the 15th District, not for anything else in the state. If I make a minimum of the vote cast here, there will be indeed an automatic and, well, relatively automatic. I should say that Illinois...
What's the minimum?
5%. 5% of the vote.
You get 5% of the vote. Okay.
If we get 5% of the vote, which we are on the ballot for a week from Tuesday on November 5th, and we will be on the ballot 2 years from now, I have no doubt at all. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, and this is an important point, because Illinois is the most difficult state in the union, with perhaps one exception, for a third party to get on the ballot. It's set up in such a way to keep third parties off. That's not surprising. I mean, what we have here is what the head of redistricting for the Republican National Committee called in the Wall Street Journal about a month ago, sweetheart gerrymandering. Sweetheart gerrymandering is where the Democrats and Republicans get together and sort of divvy up the seats.
Yeah.
You take that area, that's a Republican area, so you get a safe seat there, and we Democrats, who actually had in charge the redistricting here in Illinois, will take our own areas, and the Democrats have a majority of the areas, the Republicans have a minority, but the one we're in is supposed to be a Republican area, and no one else need apply.
Yeah.
It keeps the others out by this requirement. In our case, the requirement was to have 5,000 signatures of registered voters on notarized petitions in a 90-day period.
It's funny you should mention that, Carl, simply because the Economist magazine, not too long ago, the conservative business magazine out of the United Kingdom, ran a article basically on this point, how the U.S. Congress, out of the 435 districts, approximately 70 or 80% of them are there are no races.
That's
I mean,
right.
They've been gerrymandered in such a way that we're really down to where 70 or 80% of the American people have really no choice. I mean, they've been each party's conceded that seat to the other party,
yeah,
and isn't going to even send any money to run against it. So we're down to maybe 50
right.
to 100 races at most that are even contested, and of those, probably a much smaller percentage that are aggressively contested.
And we know that each year there is a tiny fraction of seats that actually change hands, you know, that particularly seats with incumbents in them, you know, almost never. No, it was, I think the problem is here, Bob, that the Soviet Union disappeared, you know, and so East is that style of election has gone out of fashion. It had to be back in fashion someplace, so we've moved it to the U.S. House.
We're talking to Carl Estabrook, the Green Party candidate for the 15th Congressional District. Today on Media Matters, I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our phone lines are open. We'd hope to have a debate on media policy issues with all three candidates today, but for a variety of reasons, one of which being Paul Wellstone's tragic death, we're down to one candidate who could make it today. So we switched it away from a debate format to a general question and answer. So we're taking calls. Our numbers here at Media Matters, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller who's been very patient. Hi, line one, you're on the air with Carl Estabrook.
Hello, Mr. Estabrook.
Good day.
I noticed that you did have all three candidates on the television.
Yeah, yeah.
Program the other day, there were all three.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm curious about is, I hope I don't sound ignorant about this, but what the Green Party is a little bit mysterious to me. Now, when it first appeared in Germany, I thought I understood, but listening to you the other night on the television, I just assumed that it's basically a recast version of socialism. I mean, what you talked about was socialized medicine, redistribution of the wealth, all corporations are evil, capitalism is evil. This all sounds to me like a new version of socialism with a fancy name to it. How do you differ from socialism?
Well, I'd begin that by saying, what do you mean by socialism? You tell me what your definition of socialism is, and I'll tell you whether I am one or not.
Well, one of the main things is that it involves authoritarian rule from the top by people who usually alleged intellectuals like Lenin, who believe that say that everything they do is in the name of the people. You know, we're doing something great for the people, but basically we want to obliterate the kind of economic system that we have now, namely capitalism. We don't want to put thumbscrews on corporations. Corporations are evil. Capitalism is evil. Redistribute the wealth, and so on.
That's a big help because, in fact, you make two points there, and I'd like to comment separately on both of them. You're certainly right. The notion of the picture that we've got of socialism, which is basically the Bolshevik version of authoritarian rule by alleged intellectuals who rule falsely in name of the people, you've described very neatly there the sort of regime that did exist in the Soviet Union. I agree with you entirely that that is to be condemned, and we are quite properly glad to see the end of it. That is one of the that's something that belongs in the dustbin of history, and the 20th century at least saw that off, and that's all to the good. Now, one of the points to be made about it, of course, is that the reason that the Bolsheviks called themselves socialists is because the word socialist had such cachet at the beginning of the 20th century. It was such an attractive word, because at the beginning of the 20th century, before Lenin and his friends grabbed it, what it meant was democratic control of the economy. It was precisely in the opposite direction of the authoritarianism that you rightly point to in the actually existing socialism of the 20th century. The original socialists, if we can speak that way, from the 19th century were people who said democracy is a wonderful thing. We should have democracy in the polity, that is, in the politics, and also in the economy. We should establish democratic control over the economy. And that, I do believe, that's a very that is a very interesting idea, an idea that we need to resurrect. Now, let's apply that to your second point about the corporations and so forth. At the same time, Lenin and his friends were establishing an authoritarian economy in the Soviet Union. An authoritarian economy was being established in our country, too, but we did it differently because our traditions were different. We did it under the name of the corporation. But think about it for a minute. A corporation, the sorts of things that most of us spend our work lives in, is authoritarian just the way Bolshevism was. That is, decisions are made at the top. There is no democratic input at all. It says it's done in the name of the people. We work for the consumer, et cetera, et cetera. But we know from our real work lives that we actually have very little control over them. The decisions come from above. So the opposition that you rightly set forward to authoritarianism in the politics, and the economy, I want to continue and take seriously. And that is an opposition to corporate control of the economy. And by the way, that's going around the world right now. We have what is nothing less than the largest mass movement, mass political movement in human history, this opposition to corporate control of the economy around the world.
The largest political movement in human history.
It really is. Isn't that wonderful? That's what I'm talking about there is a thing that the media first noticed in Seattle in 1999, but has swept literally around the world. I mean, Washington, Quebec, Genoa, Singapore, again and again, these groups have come together. The best place we see it, as a matter of fact, was in Porto Alegre in Brazil last February, where 50,000 people representing these groups from around the world came together under the banner Another World is Possible, a world that's not based on an authoritarian economy. And I call that the largest mass political movement in human history because it does incorporate all these local initiatives, labor initiatives, self-summoned groups from all over the, literally all over the world. And this is something the Green Party is happy to be part of.
Caller, are you still there?
Yes.
Would you like to reply or ask another?
My only comment, I guess, is that no doubt there is some kind of authoritarian element in corporations, but the whole point is that corporations can fail. They can, if they're no good, they're washed out. Whereas the trouble with socialism, when it gets its grip, is that it's almost no way to get rid of it. In other words, it doesn't have anything to counter it, because invariably it's got some sort of authoritarian grip on the whole country. Whereas there's thousands of corporations, and if they don't cut the mustard, they're dead.
Thank you very much, Carl. That's a good point. You know, Carl, that reminds me of the classic critique of socialism, which is really, I think the caller's done an excellent job of getting right at it, which is that under socialism, economic and political power are combined by the same polity. Now, they might be run democratically, but it is one group that sort of has all that power. Whereas whatever you might think of corporate capitalism, corporations can't lock people up and kill them. They have to work through a government, which is a separate group of people, in theory, let's say. You're laughing.
Well, no,
but,
I'm
you know,
just,
but my, you don't understand the point, which is there is a diffusion of power between the economy and the polity, which leaves more space for human freedom. I mean, this is the classic Milton Friedman critique.
And I think the principle is correct. That's what we want. We want that diffusion of power. We want that that democratic control in both the polity and the economy. The problem is that although corporations are justified in its name, they don't in fact represent that. Investment decisions in this country, the decisions of the most basic issues of what the economy produces and who gets jobs in producing it, those decisions are not made publicly, Bob. They're made by a little group of willful men, to borrow a phrase, on the board of General Motors or on the board of the Fortune 500. Now, this is not democracy, and in spite of the theoretical sort of economics 101 notion of you and I can suddenly get together and decide to become an automobile corporation or something like that, we know that's not quite true because that's not the way the economy is ordered. We have the most unequal division of wealth of the industrialized world in the United States, and that unequal division of wealth is held in the hands of those corporations, in the private hands of those corporations that make those decisions. I want to make those decisions publicly.
We're talking to Carl Esterbrook, the Green Party candidate for the 15th Congressional District here in Illinois. He's our guest today on Media Matters. If you were listening in, expecting to hear also Josh Hartke and Tim Johnson, the Democratic and Republican candidates, each of them is not here for different reasons we explained at the outset, and we much regret their absence and hope that at some point they will return to our airwaves. In the meantime, we do have a guest who did come, and we're delighted to have him here, Carl Esterbrook. If you'd like to call in and speak with Carl, the number is 333-9455, and the toll-free number is 800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Champaign-Urbana, you're on the air with Carl Esterbrook.
Hello. Yes. May I speak to the comments of the previous caller? At least I think he's the previous caller.
Yes, you certainly may.
He asserted that once a socialist government or regime was in power, they could never be put out, or at least almost couldn't be. I would point out to them that not so terribly long ago, England was governed by a socialist government, and that they were certainly voted out after, I think, 6 years. That was back in the 1950s. I think all of the Scandinavian countries were socialist at one time. I think the socialist governments in all three of those countries have since been voted out and perhaps will be voted back in again. They were quite successful while they were there.
Okay.
I would also say that the mayor of Milwaukee during the Milwaukee Glory years was a socialist.
Did you have a question?
And yes, I would like to get to the question now. What do you think of instant recall or instant revoting?
The instant runoff system, you mean, that they've established in San Francisco, for example. That was established under green auspices, as a matter of fact. The Green Party...
Carl, can I just stop you?
Sure.
Why don't you explain what instant runoff voting is? We've talked about it before on the show once, but not all our listeners listen to every single program.
There are various systems. There's a very good book, in fact, on the...
Stephen Hill.
Thank you. you're omniscient, Bob. I'm impressed. Stephen Hill's book on the subject, in which the... and Stephen was involved in the San Francisco initiation. But basically, what this does is it gets away from the spoiler charges in elections. And I would be very happy to have it in the 15th Congressional District right now because...
Well, let me explain how it would work.
If there are three candidates, say... you rank the candidates in the order that you want them. The elimination of the third candidate means that the votes go then to the other candidates, the second candidate on your list.
So let me put this for those of us who aren't real fast. So let's say Tim Johnson, Josh Harking, and Carl Esterbrook are the three candidates, and everyone votes for first place vote. And if Tim Johnson, say, doesn't get 50%, no one gets 50% in the first round votes. Then they knock out the third place person and take whoever those people voted for as their second choice, those votes would go to. And it might be that more of them would go to Josh Hartke. And so people who voted for, and Josh Hartke might win. So therefore, people who voted for the third party candidate or the third place candidate wouldn't be penalized.
That's right.
And it would encourage new political parties, but it would also mean whoever actually won the election would get a majority of the votes.
We wouldn't have the sort of thing that we had after the 2000 election where people said, well, Ralph Nader cost Gore the election. Nader's votes would have been eliminated as the third place finisher, and those votes then distributed. And if, in fact, all the Nader votes really did have Gore in mind as their second choice, then Gore would have won in a walk.
So you're You're a proponent of this.
Absolutely. And the Green Party, I said earlier, the Green Party disagrees on a lot of things, and it does. The Green Party is a pep rally more than a settled party, but this is one of the things we do agree on. Voting reform, and there are other things to be talked about there, including proportional representation, but voting reform is high on the list of the agreed positions of the Green Party.
All right. And that would probably address some of those 300 districts where there are really no competitive races. It would make it easier for third parties to start up and more competition.
It would indeed.
All right, caller, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Line one, Charleston, you're on the air with Carl Esterbrook.
Yes, I have a question about the standardized medicine policy you was mentioning.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, please?
I think, is your radio on? Turn on. You're getting an echo here.
You were mentioning earlier.
Must have the same cell phone plan I've got. We're having trouble picking you up, Charleston. I think that we're going to have to let Charleston go. They're not, Charleston, if you can hear us, please just try to call back on a landline or something. We'd love to have you on, but it's not working right now. We have lines that are open now here. If you'd like to talk to Carl Esterbrook, the phone number is 333-9455 at Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And we do have a caller on our toll-free number from Peoria. Is that in the district?
Peoria is not in the district.
Peoria is not in the district.
Perfectly happy to talk to people from Peoria, sure.
Okay. Line 4, Peoria, you're on with Carl Esterbrook.
Hi. I understand you're very progressive on some economic issues, but on some social issues, particularly dealing with sex, you're very regressive and endorse the Roman Catholic Party line, hook, line, and sinker on abortion, divorce, condoms, homosexuality. You're very, very regressive. And the Catholic Church is a prime example of a dictatorship with a king or emperor on top of it. Its whole masses and religious ceremonies are taken over from emperor worship.
I think you may have some criticisms of the Roman Church. Am I right?
Yeah, that's right. you eat it up, hook, line, and sinker. It's despicable. The church is more democratic. It's run by a bunch of celibate males. They don't let women have a fair share of power in the church. Serve mass or anything like that, and their rituals are all taken over from emperor worship, and the whole thing is based on Roman Empire.
I don't know what mountain you were standing on when this revelation came to you, but I mean it is something that has been debated since the 16th century, since the Reformation. It's an interesting study. It's one I happen to be interested in. My academic work actually has been in that area, but when questions like this come up, I'm reminded of the remark that Will Rogers made once when he was asked about his political position, and he said, "I belong to no organized political party. I'm a Democrat." Mm-hmm. Now, that's a good line, because I feel that same way in religious matters. I belong to no organized religion. I'm a Roman Catholic. The Roman Catholic Church right now is more disarray worldwide than the Democratic Party was when Will Rogers said that it wasn't organized.
Carl, we got a lot of callers when we got in there. Rather than go into sort of a disquisition on the Roman Catholic Church, let's talk specifically about the crucial issue. Which he started at, which is your position on abortion, gay rights, women's rights. There's a litany of positions in the Catholic Church has. Now, do you share all those positions? And if you do, could you explain?
Short answer, no, not at all. Secondly, he's wrong to assume that there's even a standard list of positions there that can be ascribed to the Roman Catholic Church. The issue that a number of my friends and colleagues are particularly concerned about is the issue of abortion. My position on that does not depend on the position of the American bishops or of the Bishop of Rome. In fact, what I've said about that is that I endorse the statement of a very good group of people called the Seamless Garment Network, which is not Catholic by any means. It includes people like Nat Hentoff, who describes himself as an atheist Jew. And the statement is, and I quote it, "I'm committed to the protection of life, which is threatened in today's world by war, the arms race, abortion, poverty, racism, capital punishment, and euthanasia. I believe that these issues are linked under a consistent ethic of life." Bob, what I'm against is things that destroy human life. And I think, unfortunately, that includes the present liberal position on abortion in this country. Choice is one of the most effective public relations terms, I think, from the 20th century. When I think about my friends who've had abortions or have seriously considered them, they didn't think they had a choice. They thought, and I'm talking even about privileged people here, they thought their circumstances were such, education, money, family, whatever, that they had no choice at all, that the only thing they could do was to have that abortion. It's a peculiar society that says, look, we don't have an income for you, we don't have education for you, we don't have housing for you, we don't have a job for you, but we will give you a legal abortion.
Now, would you, if you were elected to the Congress, would you vote for a law to formally make abortion illegal and imprison people who did abortions?
I can't imagine ever voting for a law that would imprison people who'd had abortions. I think indeed,
or how about doctors?
I think indeed that we want a system that supports people, that does not call for the taking of human life. And I can imagine sanctions against abortion providers. I think that's, you know, that's a conclusion the community could come to. We're not about to come to it. I mean, this issue is a shibboleth, Bob, of the first order. One of the road warriors from the Staley strike a few years ago, one of the workers there who had gone around the country talking about it, came back to say, look, you know, they use guns and abortion to distract us from the issues of jobs and money. The abortion issue is, in fact, not an issue. Tim Johnson was right the other night when he said it was about as decided as anything is in American politics. The seamless garment people, whom I associate myself with, take that seriously. They say we don't want to. It's not so much that we want to make abortion illegal. We want to make it unthinkable.
Well, how about gay rights, women's rights otherwise? What is your position on those?
As our campaign statement says, we're against discrimination of all sorts and at every level. I mean, you know, one way this has come up is this question of same-sex marriages. This is more a personal position than the party, because the party really hasn't talked about it, although I think the party as a whole would agree. I think the state should get out of the marriage business entirely. If we had universal health care, if we had a guaranteed annual income, some of these issues about marriage would disappear, because we're talking about domestic partner domestic partnership benefits and so forth. And so the issue about same-sex marriage turns out to have economic ramifications in which the society is pretty retrograde. We've got to turn that around.
Okay, we're talking to Carl Esterbrook today. He is the Green Party candidate for the 15th Congressional District here in Illinois. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, in Media Matters. If you were hoping to hear the other two candidates speak, so was I.
Me too.
They were all invited, and we were under the impression all three would be here until just a couple days ago. We were informed that the incumbent, Mr. Johnson, would not be able to make it. And then this morning we learned that Mr. Harkey was going to be attending a memorial service for Paul Wellstone, would not be able to attend either. We have three people who have been waiting very patiently. Let's go to the phone lines now and take their calls. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Carl Esterbrook.
Hello. I tuned in late. I hope I'm not asking about something that's already been discussed. I'd like to hear Mr. Esterbrook's views about two things in the Middle East, the Arab-Israeli conflict, and the question about disarming Iraq, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Crucial questions, very, very, very important indeed. Arab-Israeli, one of the things that bothers me about the discussion is that whenever the question of Israel and the Palestinians comes up, people shake their heads and say, oh, intractable question, you know, ancient racial hatreds going back, you know, couldn't possibly do anything about it. That's ridiculous. This is one of the major questions in the world today that could be solved almost literally with a phone call from Washington. Because one of the things we should remember when we're talking about the Israel and the Palestinians is we have to talk about the U.S. / Israel and the Palestinians. Israel, particularly since 1967, is the American projection into the Middle East. We pay for that society far more than, say, the Soviet Union in its heyday ever paid for Cuba. And the reason we pay for it is not because of some devotion to survivors of the Holocaust or something like that. The U.S. is more hard-headed than that. We pay for services rendered. Israel is the American attack dog on the beat in the Middle East. I'm mixing a metaphor there, I think. In any case, the U.S. wants Israel as essentially the second strongest army in the world, to guard our oil, which is so inconveniently located under someone else's sands, you know? That's what we've been paying Israel to do for the longest time. Now, because of that, we have been willing to let the circumstances in the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip continue as they have for a long time. We've turned our back on it, in a sense, and allowed the most right-wing Israeli governments to do what they want there. All Washington has to do is insist that Israel obey international law. Does that sound familiar? Are we talking about somebody else in that regard? If Israel were to obey international law, it would withdraw from the occupied territories. It would dismantle the settlements, which the world recognizes are in violation of those laws, and allow the establishment of what the international consensus for a generation has seen as necessary there, that is, a Palestinian state that really is a state and not a Bantustan. A second word about Iraq. One of the principal differences between the Green Party and the corporate liberals in the other two parties right now, the specific differences is on this matter of Iraq. We oppose an escalation of the war in Iraq that would come from an American invasion. It's important, I think, to put it that way. Well, it's not starting a war in Iraq. We have been at war with Iraq for a decade, a war that has killed by the United Nations a specialized agency evaluation in 1997, a half million Iraqi children through the sanctions. We have continued to bomb Iraq throughout the period. The Bush administration wants to put a 250,000 man American expeditionary force into Iraq. We oppose that totally and completely. Even the CIA admits that what most Americans are scared of, that is the presumed Iraqi weapons of mass destruction getting into the hands of terrorists, that would happen under one particular circumstance, that is, an American invasion of Iraq. We oppose it entirely.
We're talking to Carl Esterbrook, the Green Party candidate for the 15th congressional seat here in Illinois. On Media Matters, I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We'd hoped to have a debate on media policy issues, but it's hard to have a debate with one candidate, so we're taking open calls from listeners, whatever you want to talk to Mr. Esterbrook about. It's your privilege. There are a couple lines open. The number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is open, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines. Let's try Charleston again. That's in the district, right?
It is indeed.
Charleston, you're on the air with Carl Esterbrook.
Hi. Hey. I like your show very much, and I'd like to turn the conversation back to domestic economics. Mr. Esterbrook has suggested that, and I agree with him, that there are great flaws in the current corporate system. I think the big question is what to replace it with, and I'm wondering in more detail, what does he envision? Does he envision restructured corporations with a different mandate and more responsibility to other than their shareholders, such as, say, Marjorie Kelly might envision of Business Ethics Magazine? Does he envision lots of privately owned cooperative businesses? Does he envision all the wealth and means of production being owned by various government agencies that we select in some hopefully democratic fashion and then decisions made by that same body? I just want to know what exactly he envisions, or maybe all of the above.
What a terrific question.
It's a great question, and I mean, it's a question for a book, because what the questioner implies, and I think that's really probably the answer that should be brought to the surface, is we're talking about a progress here, a direction, a vector. That becomes clear when we ask, what is the economic system run for right now? I quoted the other night on television one of the best historians I know, Jacob Neusner, who says, the question to ask about any human affairs at the outset is cui bono. Who profits? Whose interests are being served? Okay, if we do that, if we ask that about our present corporate economy, whose interests are being served, it's very clear. It's the interests of that tiny fraction of the community that controls wealth and power. What we want to do is change that fundamental orientation. We want to establish an economy that is not for the profit of the private profit of the very few, but is for the use of the many. And to do that, it's going to take a series of steps. In fact, the series that the caller outlined is not a bad place to start. But let's just start with the first one to see how we're going to do it right now. The immense scandals, the corporate criminality that we've been hearing about recently, and the size of them, mind-boggling, being dismissed by both of the corporate parties, the Republicans and Democrats, as a few bad apples. And we need some laws, perhaps, to regulate these bad apples. But the Green Party wants to know, how many bad apples does there have to be before you begin to think there's something wrong with the tree? Well, we think there is something wrong with the tree, that is, the economy that's being run for the profit of that few. You've got to turn that around some way. Wait, how do you do it? Well, where does the problem come from? It comes, in the first place, from deregulation. Beginning back in the Carter administration, particularly, there has been a wave of deregulations of corporations in this country, not necessarily done by conservatives either. The first wave was, in fact, sponsored sponsored by liberals like Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts. But what they tried to do was take rules off these corporations and let the free market work, yeah? Well, we saw what the free market did. We saw the savings and loan scandal, where numbers that we'd never heard of were suddenly had to be ponied up by us, by the taxpayer, to pay off this situation that had resulted from deregulation. But we didn't learn the lesson. We continued to deregulate, or maybe somebody did learn the lesson. We continued to deregulate everything from airlines to energy, and we've seen the results. Okay, the part of the answer, the first step answer, is pretty clear. Re-regulate. Establish the regulations that we had before and go further in that direction. So let's take an example. Most American corporations are chartered in Delaware. You may say, well, Delaware is a lovely state. There's all sorts of good reasons to go to Delaware, but it's not the view that they're after. They're after the easy rules that Delaware has had for more than a century for corporations. Okay, look. We got to charter corporations federally, and we have to examine how they use that charter. Anyone from the 19th century knew that a corporation was something established in the public interest, and our corporations say so. We have to insist that they begin to work that way.
We've got a packed bank of phones here, and I want to get to all the callers who are currently waiting. We've only got like 7 minutes, so let's sort of shoot through these as quickly as you can. Our guest today is Carl Estabrook in Media Matters. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with Carl Estabrook.
Hi, I've two quick questions, and then I'll get off and listen. I'm an Urbana person, and we haven't had a lot of Greens candidates for offices in the area. I was curious, what kind of response are you getting away from Champaign-Urbana and in the outlying areas? And secondly, why do you think the Democrats chose to run someone after you had already entered the race? I'll get off and listen.
Thank you very much.
Two good questions, two quick answers. The response away from Champaign-Urbana has been fantastic. I loved going on radio shows in places in other parts of the district where people call up with country accents or working class accents and say, you know, we haven't anybody been saying things like that before. We're really glad you're running. That's been wonderful. Secondly, why did the Democrats choose to run somebody? Basically because they didn't dare give us a clear shot at the Republicans. This is that sweetheart gerrymandering, you know. The Republicans and Democrats agree on a lot of things, including the fact that politics is a closed system. And they suddenly, the local Democrats, looked at the fact that if it was just the Greens and the Republicans in this race, we would get half the vote. We might win, we might lose, but we'd get half the vote. They couldn't allow that, and so they put in a spoiler. And that's look, Josh Hartke is a nice guy, but he's a spoiler. He's in there to hold the Democratic base.
Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Carl Estabrook.
Hi. I was really excited when I found out there was a Prairie Green Party, but I care very deeply about the environment, and I've listened to you quite a bit, and so far I haven't heard very much about the environment. Wonder if you could respond to that. I will hang up and listen.
Yeah, that gets to the first caller, too, said the Green Party. I thought it was an environmental movement, and then I hear you talk, and it sounds like a lot of socialism.
Well, of course, the Green Party begins exactly with the notion of the environment. That's where, I mean, the green color, the green idea, and so forth, that's exactly what it's established at. As a matter of fact, I might advertise a little here. At the YMCA on campus tomorrow at noon, there is to be a debate, Mr. Hartke is invited, in which we are supposed to be talking about specifically environment, and I'm looking forward to that because we will get back to it. The Green Party begins with the environment, but the Green Party is a movement recognized early on the only way one could do anything serious about the environment was to act politically and economically. And so you're right. That's what we're concerned about. That's where we begin. But the major threats to the environment are not you and me. The major threats to the environment are the politics and economics of the society, basically corporate culture.
Line 2, Champaign, you're on the air with Carl Estabrook.
Hi. I wanted to ask something. I don't know if it's been brought up already. I'd like to know Mr. Estabrook's position on a woman's right to choose.
We did discuss that a bit. And, I'm perfectly up to say something more about it.
And Roe v. Wade, whether you would vote to get rid of Roe v. Wade or to have a constitutional
amendment yeah.
that, et cetera.
Yeah. As I said before, it seems to me that what's at stake here is protecting human life, and that includes, watching my own children be born, I just can't see how I protect their human life an hour after they're born, and that they have no rights to that protection an hour before they're born or a month before they're born or whatever. And I want to work on a society in which those things are protected. As my friends in the Seamless Garment Network say, abortion is violence against women. And if we're interested in nonviolence, that's one of the things we have to stop. We have to think about. As far as the legal structure to be found here, that's a more difficult problem. Once again, I'd like to broaden the issue. I'd like to put it in a bigger compass. I'd like to talk about universal health care. I'd like to talk about support for human life. If within that, you find a circumstance in which the necessity for abortion is much less, I'd be happy. And so are a lot of people who think that abortion is a moral or ethical choice.
Okay, let's go on. Line 4, Spring Bay, you're on the air with Carl Esterbrook.
I have a comment I'd like for you to respond to. Last summer, there was a train wreck out in the southeast, people trying to get home from work, and the rail got warped, and the 200 and some people, I think, were killed. And these are just Americans trying to get to and from work. So that's one thing, and it's about values. I think we should have public broadcasting second to none, and our government support seems to be fairly low. And at the same time, I would imagine we probably put a lot of money into Voice of America to send a broadcast signal to other people in other countries. So it's about values for Americans, and I'd like for you to respond to that.
I have a little trouble seeing what's the train. What's the significance? No. I'm sorry.
We have to hurry on. Sorry. Let me phrase it. Get at the point. If we spent in the United States as much on public broadcasting per capita as Britain spent, our public broadcasting service would get roughly $18 or $20 billion a year, rather than I think $300 million. It would be larger than any other media company. It'd be an enormous. It'd be this colossal presence. We hardly spend a thing. What's your position on an issue like that?
I think the British may have contributed two things to civilization, and only two, Bob. One is public.
Are you Irish?
Does it show? The one is the BBC, and the other is beer.
Germans got credit for that.
Oh no! Okay. I'm talking about specifically British beer. I'm talking about bitter. Yeah, okay. In any case, this is amazing. In fact, I gather there's fascinating and detailed scholarship on this point. Someone called McChesney has written about this at great length, and I would recommend listeners examine that. wouldn't it be fantastic? And by the way, the British system, is really only so-so. If you spend much time in Britain, you see that the equivalent of $18 and $20 billion, is not much. You could do a lot more.
Yeah. We're talking with Carl Esterbrook. We have time for one final call. Line 3, Urbana, you've been patient. You're on the air with Carl Esterbrook.
Hi. Thank you so much. I'm wondering, Mr. Esterbrook, if you're a vegetarian, because you seem to be advocating nonviolence. So I know it's kind of a personal question, but
certainly.
I'm interested.
All right, thank you.
I'm not a vegetarian. My daughter-in-law is a vegan and is talking about that. She's detailed on it. She's worked in the campaign, and I'm very happy to have her input on the subject. It's not a step I've made.
We're talking to Carl Esterbrook. Carl, I want to thank you very much for being here. I want to apologize to those callers who couldn't get through. I'm Bob McChesney, your host on Media Matters. I'd like you all to go out and vote a week from Tuesday, whoever you're going to support. I want to thank Carl Esterbrook again.
My pleasure, Bob.
Yeah, for being here. And I'll be back next week with the two directors of the University of Illinois Press talking about university press publishing and what it means for books today and our culture. Thank you.